All right, my friends, welcome back to another episode of the Build Show podcast. That's right, my weekly time to get together with you guys and go deep. And I've got a special guest and a terrific topic today. That's right, back in the studio with Steve Basic.
Steve, howdy, and
I, I'm doing great. Steve, we're going to be talking net zero today. Why you might want to do it. The ways to get there, and we're going to spend a few minutes talking about kind of net zero, the future. Today's Build Show from the Rockwell Studios in Austin, Texas. Let's get going. All right, Steve, so glad to have you make the trip down to Austin, be in studio with me. And we've got a couple fun days ahead. Stay tuned for some cool stuff that Steve and I are working on for the kind of future. But this topic of net zero that we're talking about today is particularly pressing because you've been publishing, I think, probably depending on when this podcast comes out, we may have episode 5 or 6 going of the Build Show Build Boston series, which is going to be a net zero house, right, Steve?
Yeah, we're in the framing stages, heavy into framing, so the house is starting to take shape. And, we're taking that to zero. And I'd call it an even net zero plus because this homeowner is so aggressive, he already went out and bought his EV, and so we're going to have charging stations in the garage, and so all his transportation is going to be on his house also.
Is that the same? I think I've heard the term net positive before. Is that kind of what you're thinking for net
plus?
Yeah,
some people call it net positive or net zero plus. I mean, I can't keep up with the names, to be honest with you.
Well, define the term net zero, though. What does that actually mean to you?
So net zero to me is that basically it's a balance, an energy balance sheet that balances out at zero at the bottom of the page.
Okay.
Right.
So in other words,
you don't necessarily have to be all electric to be net zero. You can buy gas. You can just zero it out with sending power back into the grid. Or
that makes sense. So you don't necessarily even have to have in your mind an all electric house.
Right.
But it's really saying, look, at the end of the year, my utility costs, my energy use are balanced out from what I used at the house to what I maybe generated at the house.
Yeah, and I mean, you can do, you know, gas net. I think it's a dumb idea because you're always going to sell it back for cheaper than you're going to buy it, right? So I might as well make it and use it before I sell it back, just because the economics would suggest that that's the win.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Let's talk for a minute, though, on why go net zero, or why have this as a goal, because there's plenty of people that, you know, are maybe interested. I shouldn't say that. There is a small majority of people that are interested in it because they want to save the earth, because it's the quote unquote right thing to do. But I think there's a whole host of other people that have selfish reasons, which I think are perfectly valid to do net zero. Let's talk about those for a minute.
I think it's selfish, and there is a certain demographic. I probably have about 7,000 homes in the Southwest. And with the builder there, we had a zero energy package for every plan. And it was really interesting that the demographic suggested that most of the people that bought the zero energy package were either military or retired people.
Oh, interesting. Military or retired. Okay, so what is it about those two demographics?
Well, the retired one I have figured out. The military, not quite so much, but retired people, I believe, and Dan Roy, who you've met and we've been at his house,
is one of your past clients.
Is one of the past clients, zero energy, passive house, et cetera, for the same reason. They want to cut the line to energy and the economics of energy. So if the price of oil goes to, you know, $2,000 a barrel, they don't care. Mm-hmm. All they care about is the sun comes up and then the next
powers
day it comes
house.
Up and it powers my house. So they want to basically cut those ties to any energy program and basically create their own.
The thing that is so compelling, I think, about that to me, and honestly, this means more and more to me the older I get and actually think about retirement. You know, if you're on a fixed income, you know, you're making X dollars a month, maybe you've got a small Social Security payment, you're making maybe some investment income, which as my parents have. My parents have been retired a long time, and my mom in particular handles their finances and is very vocal about the market's down. You know, I'm really worried about where our retirement money is, what our income is. I don't want to take money out of the nest egg I've got, which is making money, making interest. And so as I think about retirement in net zero, I think it's a really big deal that you might not have an energy bill. You know, whether you're paying $300 a month in your electricity bill or $1,000 a month, just about anybody would be very happy to cut out a $300 or $1,000 bill from their fixed monthly expenses.
And I think it's the cutting out the worry is like they don't have to worry, right? Yet, and I always speak of Dan Roy only because he's a retired engineer that monitors the heck out of his house. So we know every number.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dan Roy, his PV system, I think it was around $35,000 when he purchased it.
$35,000.
To put it on there. And it was, I think we were probably somewhere around 10 or 11 kW for the size of it. But he's also in an area where electricity was 24 cents
per kilowatt.
So that's much higher than, say, if we go down to our buddies Will King's, who's down in like 8 or 9 cents a kilowatt. Yeah. It's harder to justify that.
Yeah, that's right.
Dan Roy's system, basically with the credits and such that Massachusetts carried, he paid for his system in something like 4.5 years.
How about that? Dang.
And so imagine owning a house and in 5 years telling yourself that I will never have to pay to cook, heat, cool, plug load. And him and his wife drive electrical vehicles on their house.
So not only is he not paying his heating and cooling costs, he's not filling up his gas tank either because the sun is filling up his gas tank while he's home during the day. Right?
He has the best retirement plan in America.
That's pretty slick.
He is very, very slick. And the other plus is he lives in the national grid up by us. If you put stuff back into the grid as surplus, you can defer that power to pay somebody else's bill.
Oh,
so
really?
He pays like 25% of his sister-in-law's electric bill.
Oh my gosh, that's
with
crazy.
His house.
How cool is that?
So he's total zero energy and he's subsidizing his sister-in-law's.
That's awesome.
It's crazy.
So there's more than just I want to save the earth or I want to do the right thing for whatever political party you subscribe to. Let's talk for a minute about comfort and this X factor of living in the house and what's it going to be like to live in this net zero house. Because I think that's something that I've always lived in a relatively crappy, not very well insulated, not very well air sealed Texas house that I was used to pretty high electric bills, but I was also used to being uncomfortable, frankly. Right. And that's something in my new house that's been a little weird for me. Like we had a cold snap before Christmas where it was 15 degrees out, which is very unusual for Texas.
Right.
My heat didn't turn on until a couple of days into that cold snap.
Yeah.
And that's kind of weird in some respects for me. Like I'm used to, oh my gosh, it's going to be cold. I got to turn my heat up and I got to make sure I've got my big thick blanket on my bed. And instead, I didn't do either one of those things living in my house. It was weird. And it's a whole nother level of I want to build for comfort that I've seen you do for years in your cold climate. And for instance, I remember one of the first times I ever met you, Steve, was a house that we made a killer video on. A house that had European triple glazed windows.
Yep.
And you said to me, and this is, you know, when I barely knew you, like, it really makes sense to me to put that triple glazed window in, not for the energy savings, but for the comfort on the person sitting on the other side of that window who's not going to feel cold next to that window.
Right.
Will you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, I mean, so basically most of our clients come to us saying, I want you to design our house because we want a really good, comfortable house. I mean, I have a client in South Dakota right now. Every time I talk to him, he ends the phone call with, I can't wait to live in my new house here in this 20 below weather. You know, so he's like dying to get in there. But the reality is that, you know, we're talking about zero energy, but when you're building a house, you need to make the right decisions and build the right house, like you did at your house in Texas and making those right decisions. Mm-hmm. I mean, you talked about your energy. Dan Roy lives in a cold climate outside of Boston, and his house, the heating doesn't come on until about the second week of January. Like right about now, he starts getting calls for heat, and his heating heat pumps shut off somewhere around the second or third week of March.
Holy cow.
He has about 8 weeks worth of heating out of a year Boston.
Jeez, that's crazy.
And so if you can take that house and you can diminish the load, the heat load and cooling load. I mean, you're probably not going to diminish things like cooking and hot water load, but if you can diminish the other two and build a really good house, then it just means that getting to zero energy is that much easier.
Yeah.
And it makes it far more attractive.
Yep.
Right? Because if I build a crappy house and then I say, okay, to go to zero energy, it's going to cost me $60,000 in panels. I ain't doing that. That's crazy.
Yeah.
But if I build a really good house and it says, okay, panels cost me $32,000. That's far more attractive, especially knowing that in 3 or 4 years, that's going to get paid back.
Yeah.
So that
kind of begs the argument, or you may have answered it already, but one of the things I wanted to ask you was, you know, what do you say to the argument of, well, just build the house to code or just normal, and then we'll bolt on some solar. In effect, any house could be technically net zero. Yeah. What would you say to people that tell you that?
I mean, a lot of municipalities make that argument already for me, because they'll say things like, well, we're not going to pay anything back on a system larger than, say, 14 kW or 15 kW. Mm-hmm. So they put limits on it because, I mean, energy companies are in the business of selling energy. And if I go and make my own energy, mm-hmm. I'm effectively putting them out of business.
Right.
And when I send it into the grid that they pay the maintenance for, and then I ask them to give me money mm-hmm. to take it, then they're at a total loss. So they have, you know, they're trying to be the do-gooders because the government says, hey, you got to have these programs and blah, blah, blah. But they're putting caps on it. And the Build Show Build Boston client, Scott, he actually petitioned the state, and I believe he got it to move from like 15 kW to 25 kW.
Wow, how about
that? So you can put a larger system. And so he was fighting that battle, and he had
a bunch
of the state people.
Way to go, Scott.
And he's definitely a go-getter.
He's a powerhouse, that guy.
Yeah, he is.
No doubt about it.
But so some municipalities put the limit on it, but it doesn't, I mean, I'm in the business of designing houses for people. It's like, don't come at me and say, I want to build a piece of crap. That's not what we do.
Yeah, and I would say that the usual thing that I tell people when it comes to that question of, well, why don't we just build a less good house and we will bolt on these things later, is that, you know, you're going to remodel your kitchen most likely, or the next owner will, within 15, 20 years, no matter how cool it is. You're probably going to get tired of your bathroom tile. Your furnace is going to poop out at 25 years. But when was the last time you took a remodel on so that you could change out your insulation package, or you're going to change out your windows?
Windows are always a challenge. That is a definite, like, stopping point in any remodel. Should we replace all the windows or not? Because it's always a big ticket
these
item.
These systems should be in the house for decades and decades. And so to get those right to begin with, you have to do it, because you're never going to go back in 10 years, 20 years and redo those systems. So it's a hard one for clients to totally get and go for sometimes. But more and more we're getting clients who come to us and are interested in those things. And honestly, that's the big reason why you're shooting Build Show Build Boston, and why I'm shooting my version of the Build Show, is we want to encourage more and more people to build better. Because that's how we get a whole series of houses throughout the whole U.S. that are more resilient, that are more durable, that are healthier, that have better energy and lower energy bills, and that are ultimately houses that are going to be lasting and durable. That's really the reason.
Well, for some people, you know, PV systems and zero energy is like an alien spaceship, right? They don't know, they don't realize how easy it is to happen. I mean, there's a lot of companies out there. I mean, it's pretty easy. We get the people that we work with, solar companies, they come out, they do their little bit of testing or whatever, and they set up, you know, a proposal for the system, and we walk through it, and they give us a payback in time. I mean, all these things are pretty easily calculated today. Although what's interesting is two clients, Dan Roy was the first one, and then I suggested it to another client that did it. Dan Roy didn't trust anybody's calculations. So we built the house. He lived in it for 14 months before he bought his PV.
Because he wanted it out.
Because he wanted to establish what his loads actually were.
That's
for
awesome.
Living in there for over a year.
That's very cool.
And then he designed the system, and I think he added like 10 or 15%, and he lives below that.
That's awesome. How
cool
is that?
It's a great way to do it too.
So then let's talk about this specific house, the Build Show Build Boston house, which is actually not too far from where you live and where your office is located. What were some of the ways that you used to get to this net zero?
So I call
this particular build?
I call it a passive house inspired house.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I do that is because we're not seeking certification with passive house. But we're using the passive house strategy. We have really good insulation.
Mm-hmm.
We get rid of thermal breaks by using Zip R9 on the outside of the wall. We do a 24-inch on center frame. So every little decision adds 2 or 3% in our favor.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time we're done with those 20 decisions, we have a house that's 40, 50% better. You know, we're not striving for the 80% better because we don't have to.
Yep.
We just need to get it to the level where the PV system now makes real sense.
Yeah.
Right. And it makes it easy for the PV system to overcome the load. So if
Got
we bring
it.
Those loads down, then we don't necessarily have to strive for passive house because I can take that last 30% and simply invest it in the PV panels.
That makes sense.
And I end up in the same bracket in the end.
That's a really smart. So in other words, you're going to end up being about 50% better than code on both insulation and airtightness.
Yep.
And then you use that other additional savings, which you might have spent on certification or on higher levels of insulation. And you're saying kind of this is the level that really makes sense. Beyond that, we're going to hold on that.
Yeah, when that curve starts to flatten out, okay, we stop.
Yeah.
Let's not go any further. Let's not spend any more dollars there. We'll just reinvest on what we did.
You're climate zone 5, is that right?
Yeah, we're climate zone 5.
So what are those levels on climate zone 5? What is that kind of 50% better number that you're going for?
So we're striving for an airtightness of passive house.
Okay.
My hope is that we're somewhere in like a 0.5 range.
Okay, that's pretty tight.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be
that's
happy with anything under 1.5. I'd consider under 1 good, but under 0.6 would be where I would want to be.
That's tight.
Our insulation levels were at something like R32
on the walls.
Okay. 34, something like that.
And is that just conventional Zip R plus some cavity framing on 24-inch
on-center
framing?
Yeah, we have a Zip R, then we have a flash where we're using a new product by Natural Polymers, who was just acquired from Owens Corning.
Uh-huh.
So it's their environmentally friendly version of Close Cell.
Yep.
I did
it on the house last year too. I really liked it.
Okay.
It's bomber.
Yeah. So we got that. And then we'll fill the rest with some kind of like thermal fiber or something like that. And the rest of the remaining 3.5 inches of the cavity. All of our roof systems are in like an R70 range.
R70. Dang.
Yeah.
That's up there.
It's up there. But code by us is what? 4950.
Is that right? Okay.
So
50% better is R70, R75.
But it's really the airtightness. And we're using the Schüco USA, where we have all triple glazed windows there, which is, you know, you put triple glazed windows and the Zip R9, and, you know, you got to watch some of the videos because this one where we just talked about wall framing, I went through the building science basics of the wall frame and why that Zip R9 makes a world of difference by putting it on the outside of the building.
Makes sense.
It's not just adding R9 to that cavity insulation. It's doing a whole bunch of things. And the airtightness aspect of it, I mean, he's going to have just a really good house. And we have really good solar orientation. We have some windows that are, you know, there's a couple rooms that the heat will probably never come on.
Golly, that's crazy. How about basement insulation and sub-slab insulation?
Same thing. We're doing natural polymers. We're building a bathtub.
Oh, very cool.
And it's going
so
right
you're,
up.
So you're spraying the ground, basically.
Yeah,
the
we're
dirt.
Spraying the ground with like R20.
Okay.
We'll come up the wall with about 2.5 inches of it. So, yeah, that's going to be another, what, R15 or so. And then we'll fill the stud cavity with another R15 or so. Holy so we'll cow. Be in like 30, 35 on the walls in the basement. So, and the delta there is pretty low. So, you know, it's a really high R value, but it's not battling as much as the above grade wall systems.
It's kind of a side note, but I'm curious. I've never asked you about this before. I'm going to put you on the spot.
That's
here.
That's right.
What do you think about Zip R? And if you're listening to this and you don't know what that is, Zip R is a Huber Zip system that has polyiso, polyiso bonded on the inside. So when you nail it onto your studs, you make the sandwich of zip on the outside, polyiso, and then studs. It's rated structurally, and you have to, of course, follow the correct nailing pattern and use the right length of nails. But now you've got this thermal break on the studs, but you do have OSB, which is going to see the elements in terms of heat and cold, not water. What do you think about Zip R versus using regular zip and then putting outboard insulation? Is there any concern or is there any scenario you could see that OSB would see degradation, would see condensation, would see any issues in the future?
So the you're opening a hell of a can of worms.
I know,
here,
it's a
buddy.
Big can of worms, but I'm curious what
well,
you take on
Well, this takes you into
is.
That whole vapor argument that I don't subscribe to.
Yeah.
Right? So
that's what we're talking about for a minute, though.
To cut it short is... People, the minute you show people Zip R9, they say, oh, my God, you got the OSB. It's on the cold side of the wall. Oh, you're going to get all kinds of moisture. And there was one. This guy just posted something on LinkedIn. I kind of had a little back and forth battle with a few people there. But the reality is the minute I do that, the first question is, where is all this moisture coming from that everybody's worried about? Like, I know it's in the house, but we have a full ventilation system. Yeah. We have an air tightness that is going to be passive house or less. Yeah.
Plus, so, you've got closed cell foam on the inside.
Plus, we got closed cell foam on the inside. So the only real migration of moisture is not air transported. The migration of moisture is all due to not conduction. I just had the word. It slipped my mind.
Convection?
Diffusion.
Diffusion. There
right.
you go.
So diffusion. And you're never going to get enough moisture in the wall via diffusion to be a problem.
No, nothing.
And so from a building science aspect, the hard line is, yeah, it probably is better to have insulation on the outside of the sheathing, but it costs significantly more.
Yep.
Because now I'm putting two or three trips around the house.
Yeah, that's a great point.
As opposed to one.
Yeah, it's a great
point. So Huber makes it easy, but to make it easy means you have to pay attention to some other details.
Yeah.
And you have to get the air tightness right. I mean, if you told me you're doing Zip R9 in Minneapolis and you're doing a bat in the wall that doesn't, and you're not controlling moisture in the house, then I'd say, yeah, you're probably going to be in trouble.
There could be some issues there.
Right.
You're not going to be in trouble necessarily, but there could
there
be some
could
issues
be,
there.
There definitely could be some issues
We need
there.
To always have our building science glasses on. To say, you know, what's our level of risk? I have a good story about that. About 3 weeks ago, right after that big polar vortex we had that was super cold across the country, I got this email in from somebody who was a build show watcher that was really angry, like, oh my gosh, man, I bought these windows that you recommended on this video and they're absolutely failing. And I don't want to say the manufacturer because we all know who it is. And so I thought, oh my gosh, you know, is this a problem? And you know, this manufacturer hasn't sponsored me in a while, but I still think they make a good product. So the guy, I send him a Zoom link and say, hey man, why don't you let's get on a Zoom call just for 10 minutes. I'm going to talk to you about this and figure out what's up. So he sends me some photos, and granted he's in Minnesota. It was just minus 10 outside when he took these photos. He has not just condensation, but like ice on the inside of his windows. And it was on both fixed windows and some casement windows. And as I talked to him, I realized, oh, I know exactly what's going on. And you're an engineer. Let's talk about this because you're a smart guy. Mm-hmm. All we've got going on here is a dew point issue. You have fiberglass double glazed windows, which are great windows, and they meet code probably in Minnesota as well as Austin, Texas. They're probably a U factor of 0.30, let's say. Fiberglass frames. Well, guess what? Fiberglass still conducts some heat and some cold. And when it's minus 10 outside, guess what? That fiberglass on the inside of the window is really friggin' cold. Right. And you've got moisture in your master bedroom because your bathroom's right there. Mm-hmm. And as a result, the dew point on those windows is low enough that condensation's going to form. And because it's cold enough and it's below 32, now ice is forming.
Yep.
And I said, look, the manufacturer didn't do anything wrong. This is not a defect. You just need to know that when you buy a window, even though it meets code, if conditions are right, you can have condensation, even ice forming on your windows. It brought me back to that conversation that I had with you years ago, which was, look, when we buy these triple glazed windows, there's a whole host of other benefits.
That surface temperature, and there is. I had a similar story, a client. We did a brand new house for her. The husband calls up and says, Steve, you got to get over here. My wife is pissed. We have ice all over these windows. You said we were going to have a good, comfortable house. And, you know, so I get there. She's reading me the riot act. I said, listen, let's just go up and see what we got here. Because it was only like four or five windows, which I was suspicious of.
Yep.
Right? Like, why is this only happening to four or five windows? All right. So we get up there and I look and I say, wow, look at these shades. They were almost quilt-like. She goes, oh, yeah, those are for my girls. Those are light-blocking shades. I go, okay, so those are like blankets. I say, you put them down every night? She goes, oh, yeah, we put them down every night. They cover the whole window opening.
I love it.
I said, okay. And I said, this little blue thing in the corner, what is that? Oh, that's the humidifier. We run it every night. My girls, they sleep great in here. I said, do you close the door? She says, oh, yeah, every night we close the door. I said, okay. So you basically run the humidifier. It's raining in here. And then you chill that window to about 30 degrees.
Uh-huh. So what do you think is going to happen? Temperature,
exactly.
Right?
You can't get in there. So I said, what do you think is going to happen? Yep. How about tonight? Don't turn the humidifier on. Leave the door open and don't put the light blocking shades.
And I bet there
and
won't
I bet
happen.
You there won't be any ice.
Oh. That's exactly right. It's simple physics. But you have to think about it, right? It's not naturally intuitive for that client,
no.
Nor for that engineer who called me about his windows that he was trying to poke the manufacturer about changing.
Yeah, they're quick to blame.
It's simply a matter of, you know, when you get a more efficient window, it's going to warm up the frame, and then you have less chance, not zero chance, but less chance of that condensation forming on the inside of that window. And that's, you know, honestly, that brings it back to our topic in some respects of all these additional benefits for net zero beyond just a low energy bill.
Well, just making the right decisions. A good house costs money. There's no doubt about it. I'll go to my grave saying that. Any client that says, oh my God, do you know how much this costs? Yeah, I know how much those windows cost.
They were expensive.
They're good windows. Good windows cost money. How much did your car cost?
Yeah.
Right? That's a really nice, sweet looking car.
Yep.
That wasn't cheap.
Yep.
So, you know, those things. And the beauty is whether you choose to do the solar panels or not and take it to zero energy, or if you go to near zero energy or whatever label you want to apply to it, the bottom line is you end up with a really comfortable, good, functioning house.
Yep.
That your family can be in, you're comfortable, you're not getting sick. I have at least a dozen clients that I could bring in here and every one of them and say, I hate leaving my house because it's the best environment I know.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
And you probably feel that way about your house.
I totally do, yeah. 100%. It's been unbelievable. It's so night and day compared to my old house. I don't even know what to say.
Yeah.
It's so crazy. The other thing that's interesting about that conversation about the windows and that condensation is that, you know, over the years when I've valued engineered projects, and this is probably a whole nother podcast. In fact, we've been talking to Tim about the three of us podcasting on value engineering.
Yeah.
But there is a price to be paid when you choose a less costly build, a less costly material, or even just in this example, a less costly window. It's not just function, it's performance, and you pay now or you pay later.
Right. Right. Yeah, you buy a cheap window. First of all, the builder now has to mess with it to install it properly.
Yep.
And when I say install it properly, like I've seen some of these cheap vinyl windows, like there's no way you're getting that thing square, plumb, level.
Floppy
the thing
noodles.
It racks. The European windows, every builder I've ever worked with said, yeah, they were the heaviest windows I ever installed, but they were the easiest because they were true, they were square, and I couldn't rack them.
Yeah.
And so there's the whole installation, But yeah, when things fail, homeowners are quick to say, oh, the builder did this or that. No, you bought a piece of crap. You made me sharpen my pencil too much.
Yeah, that's
right. Is the problem.
And you don't remember that we made those decisions together to choose that less costly product rather than the more costly product. So you can't expect the performance of the more costly.
And it's tough because a lot of clients, you know, when I sit there and say, hey, why don't we try and knock 500 square feet off of this house? Maybe you don't need 5,200 square feet.
Yeah.
Right? Let's get rid of the third living room.
They can't possibly
get rid of
that.
And then we can pay for those windows real easy.
That's right.
Right? We'll just slop that or lop off the fifth garage or fourth garage. And then we can pay for those windows real easy. No, I need that, Steve. My daughter's going to be getting her license and we're going to have another car. And
every builder and remodeler who's listening to this has a story probably in the last week or two where a client came to them and said, oh, Steve, I got this architect who will do it for XYZ. Or Matt, this builder would do it for X fee instead of yours. Why are you so expensive?
Yeah.
I mean, everyone who's listening to this podcast has had that experience recently.
I mean, we put up stuff on, you put it up on YouTube and people say, oh, that's crazy. We can build out here for $150 an hour. And I'm the one that goes online and I say, no, you know what? You're calling me a criminal. You're a criminal.
Yeah.
If you're building a house for $100, $150 a square foot, you're the criminal.
Yeah.
Not me.
100%. No doubt about it. Gosh, let's take a minute before we wrap this up, Steve, and talk about net zero and the technology of the future. Like this Build Show Build Boston house, you're building a killer house. Yep. But what would be different about that house if you could kind of forecast the same, a similar client to Scott comes to you 10 years from now? And by the way, if you don't know, Steve's got a daughter and a son in his practice that are starting out. So what will they be saying to you guys, the basics, in 10 years when they're going, or what will you be saying to them in terms of technology, the way to build things? What do you see evolving over the next decade?
I think materials are, I would hope that materials become more integrated, meaning that there's no reason why I should have to put a roof on a house and then put solar panels on top of my roof. Why can't my solar panels be part of the roof?
That's
or
right.
Be the roof?
Yeah.
And I know Tesla is working on it. And I was talking to you earlier, we had a project that fell through, but we were going to do a solar panel integrated roof system where the panels were the roofing. Mm-hmm. And then we'd had like special flashing kits and stuff in between the panels, but they were basically our roof. And it's done in Europe quite frequently.
Interesting.
And but it's never been done here to my knowledge. And we were wanting to be the first, but the project fell through. But I think that is important. And I think it's not only the roof. If I'm building a 2 or 3 story house that's facing due south, why couldn't my siding have some kind of PV integrated panel in it and put that up,
or I can see that.
Ways to think about it. It's really, you know, changing the way we think is important. And you know, this I learned from working with Joe is Joe's goal was to get knowledge, but Joe's goal was to change the way we think.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is when I talk to other architects,
We're talking about Joe Stiebrick, by the way.
When I talk to other architects, for example, they're like, oh, I'm not putting those ugly PV panels on the roof. Well, you're an architect. Figure out a pretty way
to put the panels on the roof
or put the panels on the wall.
Guess what? You're in charge of the design.
We're in charge of the design. So let's figure out a way to do that. Let's go to the manufacturers and say, hey, I know these panels, you know, by the time I put the brackets on and stuff, we're 3 inches. Mm-hmm. You need to figure out a way to get that down to 1.75 inches so I can integrate it with my siding system or whatever the case is. And we need to have those discussions. And they are becoming more and more. And I think it, you know, Joe was certainly the one that kicked that snowball down the hill.
That's cool. I like that. Back to that same plug and play theme, you mentioned the roof modules. This is a little bit of a side note because this doesn't necessarily relate to net zero. But in thinking about, you know, durable and long lasting things, you're not going to remodel your walls, but I always tell people you're probably going to remodel your kitchen. I don't have firsthand knowledge of this, but I've heard it said that in Europe, when you buy a kitchen or when you buy a house, you buy it in a way that you could plug it into your next house if you move.
You
kind of take it with you. Do you have any firsthand knowledge of that?
That's what I've heard too.
Could do in America?
That's why all the European like feet and everything are these modular systems that you can kind of take this mantle And I always thought that, you know, in America, that's just, that's a whole nother podcast too.
It is.
Is that we say, oh, we build it to last. No, yeah, we build it so you can't take the damn thing apart. Mm. It would be really cool if we had the foresight to put something together that we understood how it would later come apart.
Mm-hmm. And how it would be serviced later,
and how
too.
It could be serviced later. And I have some thoughts about, like, a house that could, like, just go through 500 years. And, like, the service would be, you'd be able to change it real easy and stuff. But
I built a house. I built a house before I knew you that my old business partner, Eric Rouser, who's an architect, designed. And it was a perfect wall house, my first perfect wall house. And on the inside of the house, it had no drywall. And the way Eric designed it was the second floor had these shoulder areas where we put knee walls in at about 4 foot. And you went in a service door and you had a rat run basically on both sides where you had to duck down, but you could get in there. And we put all the plumbing in the service walls. And remember, this is a no drywall house. Right. We just put one by up on the walls as a, you know, kind of shiplap cover. Mm-hmm. But basically one cool thing about that house is that there wasn't a single plumbing joint in the house that you couldn't access and see.
Yeah.
Without removing any drywall. And in fact, the kitchen of the house, we did it kind of because it was low budget, but we put an IKEA kitchen in. And remember, there's no drywall too. So we always said, look, it'd be no big deal in 5 years to come back and basically do a one day remodel on this kitchen, right? Because everything could be unscrewed off the wall, the IKEA cabinets. Yep. You could take them away. There was no end panels anywhere. It was kind of like a, what do they call that when a kitchen like dead ends into the air? I don't, there's a term for that, but
yeah,
it's not flanked by walls on either side. And funny enough, the guy that I built that house with was a single guy, sold it. It was a small house. It was like 1,500 square feet. Sold it to a single woman. She ripped the kitchen out and put a new one in. And I think she maybe upgraded to a nicer European kitchen, but that's what happened to it. Right. They did a kitchen remodel in a day. And the only thing there was is some touch-up paint. There was no drywall to be done. All the mechanicals are right there. It was super easy for the plumber to just unplug and plug in the new sink, the new dishwasher, the new refrigerator, whatever. And I've yet to do that again, that no drywall concept where you could fit everything. But I really like that idea. And at my house, I didn't quite get there. But almost everything that I would need to service in the next 25 years, I put an access panel in. So, for instance, I used Aquar hose bibs.
Yep.
And everywhere that hose bib from Aquar, which is a stainless hose bib, has a connection to PEX, I have an access door there. So that you could pop that out. You could pull the Rockwell bat I've got in that spot, and you could see that 90-degree joint that connects the PEX piping, my Uponor piping basically, to my Aquar fixture. So in the inside, you could unscrew that, put a new one in, pop it back in, and there's no drywall repair. There's just an OD little plastic access box. And also put them in like out of the way places. I got one in my media closet where all my equipment is. I have one in my master closet. I have one in my pantry. I really tried to make them in secondary spaces. As a side note, I saw yesterday at a job site an HVAC guy that had the same thought on his condensate drain, where he had a brand new type of valve I'd never seen before. He called it a Johnson valve. And on the condensate drain up by the AC, by the Mitsubishi unit, it has a valve. It has a fitting you could plug in for your compressor. And then it has a valve that you can turn one way and blow air back towards the machine, or turn it the other way and blow air down towards your sink.
Oh, wow.
And he was like, yeah, I'm putting this in so in 25 years when someone has a service call for algae growth in there, they can blow it out without having to cut or do anything.
Yeah.
It's all ready to go. I was like, now you're a guy I like.
That's the kind of
way to go, Nacho.
Yeah.
Isn't that cool?
That is cool. It's that foresight. It's, you know, we get so hell-bent on building to last, we don't build, you know, and think about what we're doing. I had somebody come to me one time and said, you know, hey, do you think you could design a 500-year house? And I said, to last 500 years? And they said, yeah. I said, probably not. And they're like, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, chances are the windows, and there's going to be some parts that are going to have to get replaced. It's like saying, can you build a million-mile car? Probably not. You're going to have to change spark plugs, maybe some brakes. And
maybe even the engine.
And maybe even the engine. But the reality is I could build a house or design a house to be around for 500 years.
Yeah.
You just have to think about, okay, how are we going to replace these windows and put in that forethought.
Yeah, that amount of service and upgrade.
Yeah.
We'll end on this note, but that is the concept that Joe Stieber came up with on what he called the perfect wall. In one of his articles that he wrote on buildingscience.com, he calls it the 500-year house.
Yep.
And that house that we built that didn't have any drywall on the inside, I think it was Eric, the architect, that came up with that idea. I liked that concept of no drywall because that drywall hides big issues and small ones, for that matter. Yep. And, you know, how many times have you and I gone to remodels and been like,
oh, I didn't
know that was in there. That's a good way to say it. It delays your knowledge.
Yeah.
Like, oh, crap, there's mold growth on that drywall. There's air leaking. And there's condensation on the back.
Which
is
scary.
This window leaked and I didn't know it.
Because I see some houses, like passive house level houses, get built. And you know, I'll be talking with my kids and I'll say, yeah, see that window? The only way you're going to know that's failed is when that window's laying down on the lawn in like 15 years. Because the wall's 12 or 14 inches thick, you're never going to know.
Yeah.
It's going to rot out and then it's just going to fall out of the wall.
That's right. If it can't dry, it's going to die,
exactly.
As David Nicastro says. And if that wall that's 14 inches thick, it's water in it, there's nothing but rot happening.
No. Not at all.
I learned that lesson the hard way as a young builder when I was 30 years old. This is why I got into building science. When I was 30 years old, I joined this builder in Portland, Oregon, who was a semi-custom builder. And they had gotten talked into doing EIFS at the builder show. Oh, this fake stucco is half the price and it's insulated. They're like, great, let's do it. Well, it was face sealed. And everywhere a window or a penetration happened, you had to caulk it perfectly. And they were basically sticking this EIFS right onto plywood. And so here I'm like 30 years old. I'd worked for a production builder. I didn't know a thing. I barely knew.
Caulk it up. Seal it up.
For sure. So here we're taking these houses apart that are a year old. It's real plywood sheathing, and it's rotted because water would get in and it had no place to go. And man, I was like, oh my gosh, like what is going on? These houses are really young. Are all those other houses I built failing as well?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started digging into this whole building science. I didn't do it because I wanted to save the earth. I didn't do it because I was interested in building green, which was the big conversation then. I was simply interested in it because I was trying to prevent my company from going out of business and from getting our tail sued off. And honestly, that's still the big reason why I care about building science, is from not losing my shirt as a builder. And not doing things that will get me into trouble. And that's one of the things that I'm so thankful that I've met guys like you and Jake Bruton and all the other Build Your Network contributors, is because you're not afraid to teach people and reveal your mistakes in the past and say, hey, look, here's the reason why you want to do this. And here's the problems I found when I did it this way, or here's my specific issues. I've certainly made many of those videos over the years where I've made mistakes and I had to own up to them. And so, Steve, I want to thank you for the service that you've given to our industry, for shooting videos on BuildShare Network, for podcasting on your Unbuild It podcast, for all the articles you've written in Fine Home Building and General Light Construction over the years. You are just an absolute wealth of knowledge. You are a legend in our industry. And I'm really, really thankful to be able to learn from you. Here's our segue here to end with, to learn from you on the Build Show Build Boston series.
There you go. And that's what that's all about, right? It's, you know, people, you can have whatever you say about, oh, you know, they're just doing this to sell products and stuff. No, everything that is in the Build Show Build Boston is a product that I've already used and I believe in.
Yep.
And we're using it there. So that's out. And the whole purpose of the Build Show Build Boston is to bring those real life decisions.
Yeah.
So when you watch, and you know, I get in trouble with Guthrie because he says, okay, today we'll do like a 40 minute.
That's
and,
our producer.
And,
Randy
and I
Gilder,
shoot
by the
two
way.
Hours worth of video. And he's like, what am I going to do with this? Right. I only needed 40 minutes. But the reality is there's so many decisions to be made,
yes.
And making the right decisions and understanding why should we choose that decision.
Yep. Yep.
And it's okay if you want to do something else, but you have to understand the ramifications of doing something else.
Yeah.
And you know, the build show, and I'll, you know, reciprocate and thank you, because the Build Show in general is about bringing information today to the industry.
Yeah.
Right? Every one of our Build Show videos, whether it's Brett, Jake, Wade, Zach on his vacuum cleaners, I had to throw that in for him.
He winked at you, by the way, Zach. You probably didn't see the video, but he winked at you.
But these guys are not talking about stuff that they read in a book or stuff that they did 10 years. They're talking about stuff they did last week or this week.
That's right.
And even me, I went out Saturday with my son. We shot like 8 videos of framing that is going to be public here in the next month or so.
That's awesome.
This is stuff we're doing now.
That's right.
And these are the decisions we're making. This is how we see it. And I'm not only putting it out there because I want to, you know, share it with you. I want you to come back and challenge me.
Yep.
I want you to create the discussion, because if you create the discussion and I have to defend myself, somewhere in there, we're both going to become better for it.
That's right. That's right. And what does the 35-year-old non-gray-haired Matt need to know about this topic? Or what does the 35-year-old Stephen Basic before you went gray need to know about this topic? And what we're shooting out there, what we're doing with the podcast, I can tell you, Steve, it's making a difference. And you and I hear it from people all the time, including those that are listening right now or maybe watching the podcast. By the way, if you want to see Steve and I's beautiful gray hair, you can watch this on buildshownetwork.com, where we publish the video version of this podcast. But
there you go.
Steve, we need to move on. We got a ton of stuff to do with you. You're in Austin for 2.5 days.
Let's make it happen.
We need to move on to the next topic. Guys, really, really appreciate you joining Steve and I for this discussion on net zero. And my hope is that you learned not just how to get to net zero, but really how to reason with your clients on why this should be part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that I've really learned from Steve over the years. And I do want to say a big shout out to your client, Dan Roy, who opened his house up to you and I years ago for a tour that really opened my eyes to, you know, why is this important, and how could I sell this to a client? And Dan's the perfect client who is both an engineer and a nerd and a client and just a terrific, fun guy who was able to show off his amazingly well-built, well-designed house and is a true believer in building to net zero, not to save the earth necessarily, but okay, maybe that's a great side benefit, but because there's so many reasons that he would personally benefit from that.
Yeah.
And that's ultimately what I was hoping for listeners to get
out of
this.
It's interesting because you mentioned Dan as an engineer. If I look at my demographic of like recent clients, I would say probably 80% are extremely successful engineers in what they do and thinkers. So they understand there's a value there.
That's right.
They're just trying to understand what is that matrix that makes it successful for me.
That's right, for sure. Guys, go follow Steve on Instagram, Stephen Basic Architect on Instagram. He also has an awesome podcast with our mutual friend Jake Bruton and Peter Yost, the Unbuild It podcast. And of course, Steve is shooting videos at his job site and pulling out his infamous red marker called Big Red, his Big Red Sharpie, and showing you the details, which is, as far as I've seen, 100%. Unique in the world out there, showing you how he came up with the detail, showing you the actual detail, and revealing what many would call his trade secrets. And so thank you, Steve, on behalf of the industry for leading the way and showing us how to build better houses. Guys, if you're not currently a subscriber, hit that subscribe button below. We've got new podcasts every Friday. We're now on season 3 of the Build Show podcast. Follow me on Twitter, Instagram. No, follow me on Instagram or TikTok. Otherwise, we'll see you next time. Build Show Podcast.